Good morning and welcome to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Today we're speaking with Jennifer Robson, who's just brought us a new novel, Good Night from London. Welcome to Storylines, Jennifer.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Jennifer, Good Night from London has been described as the ultimate trifecta of suspense, romance, and unputdownable prose. I love that quote from Redbook. So tell us a little bit about, just a wee bit of the plot line.
So the plot line takes up in the summer of 1940, when I take my heroine, Ruby Sutton, who is a young weekly news magazine journalist, and I send her to London, which is kind of the beginning of what was the European war then. It had not fully become a world war. And so she's sent over to report on the war, not only for her magazine in the United States, but for Picture Weekly in London.
And this is a big deal for Ruby.
It's her big chance. And she's somebody who's had very few opportunities, who comes from a very modest background. So she goes overseas, and it's not an easy journey. You couldn't just hop on a plane. You had to go up to Halifax and get a berth on one of the convoys that were going across, because of course shipping coming from North America was being attacked. So there's the perilous journey, the arrival in London, and then just as she's getting to know her colleagues at the magazine, starting to make a few friends, that's when the Blitz begins in September 1940, and life becomes very perilous, very difficult, very exhausting for her. Mm-hmm. And so we follow Ruby through the course of the war. Along the way, she becomes homeless at one point and is taken in by a very well-known, and I should add entirely fictitious,
yes,
a family called the Tremaines, that otherwise she would never have crossed paths with.
Yes.
She makes friends for the first time in her life. Mm-hmm. And she also learns how to become a really good reporter.
And she actually surprises herself with the quality of her work.
I think she does. She'd never really been given the opportunity to spread her wings before, because she was confined to fairly pedestrian work at her magazine in the United States. And at the magazine where she works for in London, her editor is, for the time, a very broad-minded man. And he encourages her to go after interesting stories, sometimes difficult stories. And what sets Ruby apart, I think, is her humanity, that she is profoundly interested in the lives of other people, ordinary people that she encounters. And she really wants them to tell her their stories, and she listens to their answers.
And you show us the difference between Ruby's approach to stories compared with the approach of some of the other journalists, her colleagues. It's the hound after the story.
Exactly. The kind of the ambulance chasing type of journalism. Yeah. And that doesn't really interest her. She really wants to get a sense of what is it like to be an ordinary person living through the Blitz? What is it like to survive losing your home? What is it like to go through an air raid? And she recounts all this. And what it does, of course, of her stories that make it back into her magazine in the United States are helpful as a way of informing the American public about what is happening during this war, in the same way that real journalists such as Edward R. Murrow are thought to have possibly influenced the outcome of the war to a small degree, in that his broadcasts from London were so powerful and so compelling that he really helped to shift American opinion in terms of whether it was a just war to be involved in.
Right. Now, this is your fourth novel that is set in wartime. The first three, Somewhere in France, After the War is Over, and Moonlight over Paris, were set in around the time of World War I, either before, during, or after. And this is now set in World War II. So you're obviously drawn to taking your characters through the crises that come up in wartime. So tell us what that does for a character and a plot line.
Well, you can do really awful things to your characters during wartime. As my editor says to me often, she will ask me, what are the stakes? What is at stake for this character? And if it's nothing much, then you can't really expect readers to be invested in their struggle. However, if you plop your character in the middle of a world war, everything is at stake for them.
Yeah.
And so the first three books were set. My father has talked about this before. He describes the crucible of the world wars. And both the First and Second World Wars, in different ways, were crucibles that forged the 20th century for good and for ill. And the first three books, I really wanted to explore not only what happened during the Great War, but the cost of it, the cost to the human spirit, the cost to the people who survived yet were broken by their experiences. And in some ways, you know, more of that trilogy is set after the war than is set during the war. And the projected trilogy of books that I'm just starting with, Goodnight from London, is the same, in that the first book does take up the entirety of the war. And then the following books, as I envision them, will look at the aftermath and what is left after the war is won, yet conditions are really difficult for the people who've survived. And what does it take to endure the horrors of a war where you see such terrible suffering and where it seems that all of your sacrifices may have been for nothing in the end?
There's no guarantees.
No guarantees. And the bravery of the people who lived through both of these wars and both who gave their lives and survived is something that I will always be compelled to think about, to write about. And some of that stems from early experiences.
You mentioned your father. And I just clarify for our listeners, your father is a well-known historian, Stuart Robson. So you learned at your father's knee.
Yes. And it was something that I found interesting. And I'll be quite honest, I've never been that interested in the military history of the wars. What I'm interested in is how does it affect the people that live through it. So both the combatants, both the, you know, the soldiers and officers, and the ordinary people behind the lines, how did it affect them? You could not live through this era and not be affected
by
the war. Yes. So what did it do to people? And it's just a profoundly interesting question to me. So not only did I have Dad talking about it and being able to answer my questions, which was key, certainly growing up in an era before the wonders of Google, and then other influences such as discovering the poetry of Wilfred Owen, and anyone who's read his poetry, he's the greatest of the First World War poets. And the beauty of that poetry just struck me to the quick when I first discovered him when I was about 15 or 16. And then when I was 19, I had the great, great good fortune. Veterans Affairs has a program at the Canadian National Vimy Memorial in France. And I was one of the guides in 1989 who was sent over to work at the memorial for several months in the summer. And they continue to offer the program. And they also have a similar one at Juno Beach now. And I was able to meet veterans of the Great War who came to the memorial and to stand with them and to listen as they talked about their experiences.
And then later, you actually were interviewing women who had lived through the war. And this was 1990s? You were doing research?
From about 1992 to about 1994, I was working on a research project that was part of my research for my doctoral degree at Oxford. And I was really interested in interviewing women who had lived through the 1930s and the Second World War. So I mined a lot of their answers for my doctoral thesis, but I still had, you know, I had hundreds and hundreds of pages of transcripts from the interviews I did. And when I was coming to plan Goodnight from London, I had all this material at my fingertips. It was unique. Nobody else had access to this information. It was my own little repository of facts and observations and descriptions.
First-hand accounts
by women who, most of whom would have since passed away, because this was more than 25 years ago. So I went back to it and I found all just amazing tidbits about what people ate or what it was like. One woman in particular, she was the kind of person in centuries past would have been the person in the village who was given the task of remembering all the stories, being the storyteller for the village. Just an amazing, amazing lady. She lived in London during the war, and she talked about what it was like to live through the Blitz, what it was like to hear the sirens, go down into the bomb shelter, somehow make it through the night. You know, you would be so fearful. You could hear the bombs coming, and you'd be counting, and the kind of the timing of it. You'd count and think, maybe they're going to skip over where we are. The smell of it would be everywhere. The noise was deafening. You couldn't really sleep. And then in the morning, you'd get up, you'd pick your way across the rubble in the streets, and you'd go to work. There was no going home, assuming your home hadn't been bombed.
Yes.
Going home and lying on your fainting couch all day and taking a personal day because you were so stressed. No, you just went to work. You absolutely went to work. There was no choice. And then at the end of the day, you would have to then go and line up or queue up at the greengrocers, at the butchers for
your
food,
rations.
For your rations. And that would take a long time. If you're lucky, you might get home early enough that you could then make dinner for your family before you started it all over again. Mm-hmm. And remember, too, that women during the Second World War in Britain specifically were compelled to work. You had to work during the war in some fashion or another. But if you were, you know, say in your 30s and able-bodied, you were expected to take up some kind of war work. At the same time, nobody was letting you off the hook in terms of all of the domestic duties that would fall to you and you alone. And so, I mean, that fascinated me, that women were working two jobs at a time throughout the war. And what you see is very, very little in the way of complaining.
And you give us that in the book, that sense of they were completely committed mm-hmm. to do their duty in a way that was devotional mm-hmm. rather than duty.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have Hitler and the might of his armies about 70 miles away across the channel. Mm. That is very, very close. And there was, for a long time, a very real fear and very real and present possibility of invasion. Mm-hmm. And so it was a total war for the people of Britain in the sense that they were under siege, they were being bombed, and they knew that they had to give their all or risk annihilation, really. Yes. And so it's that sense of constant peril which really propels the book along.
Yes.
The minute that Ruby gets comfortable is the minute that her story becomes uninteresting. Mm. So
actually, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't lag.
Yeah.
You just keep pushing us along with a bit of intrigue, and we need to know what happens next because she is thrust into these dangerous circumstances.
Yeah.
Now we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. When we come back, Jennifer, I want to ask you about this very intriguing source of information for Good Night from London, someone in your own background. So we're going to talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Storylines on the Bay, 88.7 FM. We'll be right back with Jennifer Robson. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Storylines on the Bay, 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and today our guest is Jennifer Robson, and we're talking about her latest novel, Good Night from London. Jennifer, it's so great to have you here and be able to talk in person
about your book.
I intrigued our listeners a little bit with a very fascinating detail about the sources of your information for this novel. So there is a personal connection, and that is to your own grandmother.
There is. So my grandmother, who died not very long ago, and I miss her so acutely. The number of times in the last few years I wanted to pick up the phone and call her. So her name was Nikki Moyer. She was born in Scotland in 1919. She came over to Canada, to Vancouver specifically, when she was young. And she worked as a journalist, as a newspaper woman, as she called herself, starting in the late 1930s. And I think she really only stopped writing regularly in the late 70s, early 80s. Principally in the early years with the Vancouver News Herald, where she started in 1938, and later at the Vancouver Province, which was her favorite newspaper that she worked at as a features writer for many, many years. And so when she started at the News Herald, she was the little gopher in the office and graduated bit by bit up to doing some writing. But it was on the women's pages because that's where women's journalism resided in the papers of that time. And it was a rare female journalist who managed to break out from the women's pages, although certainly there were many well-known, well-regarded female journalists who did so. But for Grandma, you know, she had to wait until the war. So at this point, she had married my grandfather, who was also a newspaper writer. He was city editor and also a sports editor at the paper. And he left. He joined the Royal Canadian Air Force and became an information officer and was stationed in London during the war. And many other men at the paper did the same. And that left women holding down the fort, as they've done in every war you can imagine. So she was able to start work on topics and stories that would not have been available to her before the war. So she had the courts beat, as she called it. And then she also had the military beat. So with Vancouver being a port city, every time one of the big ships came in, there would be a story there. So just with her example of the idea of a woman who is in this very, very male-dominated profession.
And not like today where your rights are protected as a woman.
Exactly. And so she talked to my sister about it a few times. I was never smart enough to ask her questions, but my sister did ask her what it was like. Mm-hmm. And she did admit that sometimes there was a certain amount of being chased around the desk or having your bottom pinched, and you just put up with it. There wasn't really any other option.
Or being asked to go and get coffee while the men discussed business.
Exactly, yeah. And certainly that happens to Ruby in the book, where the man is sitting next to the coffee maker, and as an exercise of his power over her, he still asks her to go and fetch him coffee. And let's be honest, it continues to happen. But I wanted to get an insight into what it was like to be in this profession, and where the men could also be real men's men, as it were. And so that stereotype of Lou Grant with the bottle of whiskey in his drawer is not an inaccurate stereotype. Yes. And my grandfather, who was a lovely, lovely man, was nonetheless the very picture of that kind of guy, quite taciturn, not really great about sharing feelings or anything like that. Nonetheless, it was a real love story, and they were, you know, devoted to each other their entire lives. But he was an example of the good guy that you work with.
Yes.
At the very good end of the spectrum, at the not so good end of the spectrum were the men. One of whom I've created this character, an American journalist who's a former colleague of Ruby's, who is a bit of an oaf, and he's really emblematic of the type of men that she would come into contact with quite often.
You do get a little bit of delicious revenge.
Yes, yes. I had to. He's so awful. I had to make him suffer a little bit.
Nothing too terrible.
No, just mortification is all he suffers.
But you also characterize the other journalists when, I don't want to give too much away, but there is a point in the story where Ruby finds herself amongst journalists, including Ernest Hemingway. Mm-hmm. And so you've really painted a picture of what that would have been like in those times, and especially to a woman like Ruby who has worked so hard to share the air in the room with these men and her observations. And I found that very intriguing.
It was very difficult for a lot of women. And what I was struck by in reading many accounts, it's astonishing how little complaining you see. Mm-hmm. Again, like, you know, with the average person during the Blitz, you see it again with these women journalists who had it harder than the men. I have to say, I mean, they were given fewer resources. They were always at the last of the line when it came to handing out assignments or having access to things like the telegraph, so that you could send off a telegram with details of what you were doing, or even the phone lines, or even the typewriters. Yes. You were at the very back of the queue. And the fact that these women managed to not only write, but have published some really, really great stories that spoke to what happened during the war in a very compelling way. Mm-hmm. You know, I would set Martha Gellhorn's accounts of the Second World War against any other reporting. And I mean, there were a substantial number of women who became accredited war journalists.
Yes.
And some of them were, in fact, exceedingly famous women, like Lee Miller, like Martha Gellhorn. But most were doing the necessary work of just getting the story in.
Right. You're listening to Storylines. And today, our guest is Jennifer Robson. And we're speaking about her book, Goodnight from London. Jennifer, tell us what you're working on now.
So my next book, I'm setting it in 1947, so 2 years after the end of this book. The main characters are two young women who work as embroiderers for Norman Hartnell. And he was the famed designer responsible for both the Queen Mother's and Queen Elizabeth, although in 1947 she's Princess Elizabeth, for some of their most iconic gowns. Mm. And he designed Princess Elizabeth's wedding gown in 1947. And then when she became queen, he was responsible for her coronation gown. So as part of the research for this book, I went to England. I interviewed the last surviving seamstress who worked on the dress, who was one of the most entertaining and delightful people I've ever met in my life. And so much of what she told me has made it into the book. Mm. I went to see the Queen's wedding dress and coronation gown on display at Buckingham Palace as part of her 90th birthday festivities. And I also spent a day learning how to do some of the embroidery that was used in the dress. I can talk about it. I needed to have almost a muscle memory of what it's like to sit at the frame and to be hunched over, and how your shoulders get tired and your eyes start to burn.
And the concentration it would
take. The concentration and just what it's like to put your full attention to doing this kind of very, very fine work. And I loved it, I have to say. Could I do it for my whole life? I don't think so. I don't think I have the attention span. But the work itself was fascinating to me. And the place I went is a studio called Hand and Lock in London, that celebrated its 250th anniversary this year. And they still do this kind of very, very fine, meticulous embroidery that is being done, you know, in only a handful of places in the world can you get custom embroidery done for you of this high caliber. Mm-hmm. So I was very fortunate to go and be able to spend a day with one of their master embroiderers who, although the studio is in Britain, I'm writing a book set in Britain, she herself is French.
Oh, interesting.
Of course she's French, yes.
And now, in Goodnight for London, at the back of the book, you've given us all sorts of material for book clubs and and discussion purposes. Where can our listeners go to find out even more? There's so much material in the back of the book, but they can go to your website?
Yes, yes. So my website is jennifer-robson.com. And I include all sorts of extras on the website. One of the extras that I keep forgetting to tell people about, it was part of a kind of a sales initiative a few years ago that my publisher used. And I wrote a short story called, I just called it Edward's Story. And it traces what happens to the character Edward, who figures very prominently in my first two books, Somewhere in France and After the War is Over. And there's a period between those two books that is shrouded in mystery. And a lot of readers asked me what happened to him. And so I thought, well, I'm going to answer. So I wrote a short story that's on the website that I've been trying to remember to tell people about, because it answers a lot of the questions about why is Edward the man he is and why does he suffer so acutely from, among other things, post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was nice to get inside his head for a bit, even though I never wrote a book as such that was from his point of view.
So our listeners who are already fans, who might not have discovered that, have something to look forward to.
I hope so.
Yes, when they go to your website. So Jennifer, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Storylines. Thank you for telling us more about Goodnight from London, and we will be looking very forward to the next novel, also set in London. Do we have a title yet?
So my provisional title is The Gown.
Okay.
Will it stick? I'm not sure. These are never my decisions. I don't get to decide the titles. I suggest them, and then it's always a bit of a committee decision. And I have to defer to my publishers, who have worked on more books than I have and have a better sense of what makes a successful and interesting title.
Yes.
Provisionally, I think we're looking at not this Christmas, but next, say, December, January. So that would be 2019.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today on Storylines.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Storylines on The Bay, 88.7 FM. I'm Christine Cowley, your host, speaking to authors and book folks about books and the writing life. Please join us again. Thanks for tuning in.